Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you for spending part of your day with me. Professor Tressie McMillan-Cottom writes in her latest book, quote, "I hate small talk. It's small." Cottom's work is full of big ideas. It's clear the professor thinks about complex themes and issues that are nuanced, full of contention and contradiction, you know, thick. Just last week, her book, Thick and Other Essays, was named a finalist for the 2019 National Book Award in Nonfiction. Thick covers a lot of ground. Why, for black women, checking all the quote-unquote right boxes is no guarantee for success. Why narrow definitions of beauty are more than just annoying, they can be damaging. And why does David Brooks get to write for the New York Times if he's going to write about sandwiches? And how lower-income folks don't know their way around gourmet shops? And though each piece tackles a different subject and presents something different, the essays are tied together by observations that are often poignant and thoroughly necessary. Dr. Tressie McMillan-Cottom is a professor at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia, and she joins us now via Skype. Nice to meet you via Skype.
Same here, Allison. I love that introduction. That was perfect. I'm going to borrow that. Thank you.
You got it. It's a gift. My gift to you.
I appreciate that.
You know, it is the oldest maxim in the world that you should write what you know. So what was it that you knew that you wanted to write about?
I knew that what I had inherited, what black women know, our intellectual histories, our way of viewing the world, was one, underappreciated in our popular discourses, and two, critically vital to helping us understand the world. So I don't assume that my point of view is singular or that it is even the most important. But when I was looking around, especially after the election of Donald Trump, there was this sort of moment in popular discourse where we were tackling really big ideas. And I knew intimately that black women had been dealing with many of those ideas for a very long time, and that in ignoring black women's intellectual history and our intellectual production and our work and our expertise and our lives, that we were hamstringing our popular discourse's ability to understand what was happening in the world.
How does your work as a sociologist intersect with your work as a writer?
Oh, that's a great question. And sometimes I think I'm still figuring that out. So when we are trained as sociologists, we are not often expected or held to the standard of having craft as writers. But I come from a tradition of really appreciating and respecting the craft of writing. And so the challenge for me has been to take what I learned as a sociologist, which is just a really disciplined way of dealing with complex issues. It's not the only way, but I think it is a very good way. And it's one that black academics and scholars and thinkers in particular have really perfected over the last hundreds of years. And so I wanted to take being very disciplined about looking at data, but not thinking that data could be the only answer or the only way to understand the world. Our emotions do still matter. A good story, especially an empirically true story that still moves us, may in fact be some of the most important data we will ever produce when it comes to changing the world. And so I want to marry those two things whenever possible, staying true to the facts, but elevating the story that creates the sort of change many of us want to see in the world.
When did you start writing these essays, the ones that we're reading in Thick?
You know, it's interesting. I don't remember not writing them, if that makes sense. Like, so much of what ends up in this volume were conversations I was having with myself and when I would sort of talk back to the things that I was reading. And so while there was a moment in starting to write the book and putting together the essay where I thought, I can't possibly have these essays, ready to go. But when I started writing, it became clear to me that these were conversations I'd been having for a very long time. So while formally, I think, I had been writing the book for about 5 years, the work that had gone into crafting the arguments was at least a decade long, sort of spanning my public writing career, but really even earlier than that. So when I'm talking about beauty, for example, I started writing that essay when I was 11 years old and I read The Bluest Eye, if I want to be honest, right? I just finished and put the capstone on it 30 years later. But those conversations I had been in all of my life.
Who did you see as your reader as you were writing these essays? Or maybe that wasn't your concern.
When I am writing, I actually can't think about the audience. Mm-hmm. I think the teacher in me becomes too prominent when I do that. And then I want to explain everything, right? I want to assume what the audience might know. And sometimes that is not very good for writing a really good essay when you want to sort of craft an elegant argument. So when I'm writing, I actually don't think about the audience. But when I am editing, when I'm thinking about presenting that work to the world, then I start to think again about, you know, who this is for. And listen, I was very clear from the outset, as was my editor and my publisher, that I was talking to Black women first and foremost, if only to say, hey, that thing that you sometimes feel or that thing you have experienced, you're not crazy. It's actually happening. Mm-hmm. And so first and foremost, I'm speaking to us. And then I wanted to show other people, look how much better your understanding would be if you listened to Black women. But that's always secondary to me. This book is very much a love letter and a conversation with Black women.
My guest is Tressie McMillan Cottom. The name of her book is Thick and Other Essays. So we learn a lot about you in the course of reading these essays. And there's something that caught my eye. Mm-hmm. You grew up in North Carolina and you teach in Richmond, Virginia. And I know where VCU is. It is just blocks from Monument Avenue.
That's right.
So when you drive down Monument Avenue in Richmond, Virginia, former capital of the Confederacy, and you look at these big monuments every darn day on these beautiful grassy sort of meridian, will you share with our listeners what you see?
So I actually take that drive to work almost every day, by the way. It's the easiest way from point A to point B for me to get to the office. And in some ways, I hope that doesn't change, because it is interesting to live in a place that is so committed to maintaining the myth of a Confederacy that somehow won. It may not have won the war, but they are still trying to win the culture, right? And that is in selling the idea that the Confederacy was about something other than the enslavement of human beings, and creating a political and economic system that would persist in reproducing this caste system. So you drive down that beautiful street, and it is gorgeous. This is the juxtaposition of how beautiful that street is with how ugly the public memorial is something that I hope I never become too comfortable with. That jarring defamiliarization is one that I always hope I feel when I drive down that street. And I hope I always remember that for many, many other people, they don't experience it that way at all. That to me is actually the challenge of the crisis of the West, certainly, but certainly of the United States of America, and how we choose to remember this nation's history. It is interesting to live in a place that won't let the South die.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those monuments are enormous. I mean, yes, it's enormously, it's an enormous Stonewall Jackson. They're huge.
They're huge, which is why Kiende Wiley's new statue is so important. The local museum commissioned this, and it was important that he had done something on a scale similar to the one that had been done there. So usually in trying to push back against that kind of public memorial, we are relegated to very tiny statues, right? Mm-hmm. But even the scale is designed to communicate power and dispossession and oppression. And one of the things I find interesting is that when I drive down that road most mornings, there are huge crowds at the feet of those things. People come from miles around to see them, to take pictures with them, and again, to remind people that that memory for them is still very much alive.
And the reason I wanted to ask you about that, and I wanted our listeners to understand about Monument Avenue, is that because you grew up in the South, but now a lot of people are talking about this idea of the New South.
Yes.
And I'm curious how, having grown up in the South and then living in Richmond, and also this idea, I don't know how you feel about the New South, how that affects what you write.
Yeah. The New South is about how do you write a future where the South did lose, but it didn't lose entirely. And you are stuck with the problem of trying to reconcile a future when you won't let go of the past. And so the New South is really just this contradiction. I'm not sure it can happen. And I wrestle with that a lot. I love the place that produced me, that produced my people, whom I love dearly. And I'm not willing to concede my memories and my history to the myth making that a lot of the South wants to do. At the same time, I know that trying to rewrite the South as a sort of a place that's too busy to hate, for example, really plays into a really dangerous idea that we can somehow move forward without wiping clean sort of the historical slate. So I wrestle with it constantly. I don't think it can be resolved, much like the larger question of race and racism in this country probably can't be resolved. But listen, I love this place. This is the only place where I make sense as a person with my history. I'm not willing to cede it yet to whiteness and to white memorial and white memory. But I also know that ultimately probably to get what I want, which is, you know, freedom and reparations for Black people, it probably has to die.
My guest is Tressie McMillan Cottom. The name of her book is Thick and Other Essays. In the actual essay of Thick, you write, "I was, like many young women, expected to be small so that boys could expand and white girls could shine. When I would not or could not shrink, people made sure I knew I had erred. I was, like many Black children, too much for white teachers and white classrooms and white study groups and white Girl Scout troops and so on. Thick where I should have been thin, more when I should have been less. A high school teacher nicknamed me Ms. Personality, and it did not feel like a superlative. I had tried in different ways over the years to fit. I thought I could discipline my body and later my manners to take up less room. I was fine with that, but I learned that even I had limits when, in my pursuit of the life of the mind, my thinking was deemed too thick." At what point did you really realize that you were going to stop trying to accommodate the outside world, make yourself smaller, and you realized, you know, it is time to stop conforming to what other people want and think?
Far later than I wish. I wish I had figured that out, you know, a decade earlier. But I can say that when I sat down to write this book, I was just closing in on the idea that there was not a thing about myself that I was willing to change for my profession or for dominant culture to accept me, because there was something about accepting that it simply would not happen and that the price of trying to pursue it was just too high. I did not want to trade how I speak or how I write or how I think or how I see the world, because it was so valuable to me. And anything that was going to ask me to sacrifice that in the pursuit of success or belonging or assimilation was a false hope. So I wish I had known that, by the way, in my 20s. Certainly wish I had known it by 30. But sadly, I probably did not get there until I started thinking about writing this volume. And it is, I've got to say, I recommend it. It is freeing beyond all imagination. I don't know that we can ever fully extract ourselves from wanting validation or acceptance, but I do work every day to sacrifice the idea that that acceptance should come at the price of me giving up the things that I love.
And you also read, this is so interesting as well, you said, "I become more radical about some things as I get older. I'm also more forgiving of pettiness these days, even as I become intolerant of willful ignorance." What is something that you are more tolerant of these days, or forgiving of these days? And what's something that you have grown more intolerant of?
Wow, that's a great one. I don't know that everyone would agree with me, but they're not here. So I get to say that I think I'm more forgiving of people struggling with getting it right. Recently, for example, I was talking with some parents who, you know, want to learn how to talk about, white parents want to talk about race with their children, race and racism and what it means to be white. They want their children to understand that. And even in asking the question, the way they had framed it was, in the way it often is with people who haven't yet realized how these things go, the question itself was steeped in a sort of privilege and set of assumptions, right? They wanted me to give them a book list, for example. Now, you know, there would have been a time in my life when that just would have sent me sort of over the edge. Now, I still don't give the book list because that's not what I do. But I'm now far more forgiving of the question. It is a struggle, and it is a process for people to learn a new way of thinking and talking about the world. Now, at the same time, I tell people, however, teaching them is not my ministry. People have different gifts, and me teaching white people how to be better white people is not one of mine. However, I don't get quite as upset about it. I am, however, deeply intolerant of institutions, our media outlets, or our political apparatus, or our schools, who will not do the hard work of doing what we know is the best thing to be done. I become deeply angry about that and like to focus now sort of my energies on those issues.
My guest is Tressie McMillan-Cottom. The name of her book is Thick and Other Essays. We'll have more with Tressie Cottom after the break. Stay with us. This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. My guest this hour is Tressie McMillan-Cottom. The name of her book is Thick and Other Essays. It was recently named a finalist for the 2019 National Book Award. Your essay on beauty, the inspiration for it came, this is when you received backlash about a piece you'd written about Miley Cyrus.
No. And,
so I don't know if people remember, but Miley Cyrus was on the Video Music Awards and she was twerking and she had a group of singers and performers on stage. And it's interesting, though, that the backlash was from Team Black Women.
Yes, yes. Which I take seriously. So, yes.
So what had you written that upset them so much?
I mean, first of all, I don't know that I'm ever going to forgive Miley Cyrus for figuring so prominently in my intellectual life. So I had written this essay about Miley Cyrus's performance and my feelings about who her backup dancers were. Now, people were commenting that her backup dancers were Black, that they were dressed a certain way, provocative, that they were moving a certain way, a way that we often think of as provocative when Black women are doing it. But many people had not cited how those bodies looked. So these were thicker Black women. They looked, frankly, like me. And so I felt I had a certain emotional response to that that was a bit different than other people's who were writing about it at the time. And so I wrote something to the effect of why Miley Cyrus wanted that particular performance of a Black woman's body behind her, that she had chosen a sort of embodiment of white culture's assumptions about Black women's beauty, I think, if not deliberately, then certainly with a certain intent, right, to highlight her whiteness, even as she was doing a sort of performance of musical blackface. And I thought that that's what that visual juxtaposition was doing. Listen, Black women took me to task for the essay. There was everything from, you know, if you hate yourself, that's on you, but those women were beautiful, to Miley Cyrus appreciates, you know, Black women's beauty and is putting it on stage, and they're probably really great friends. And so there was a lot of pushback about me seeing myself in those dancers and wrestling with the idea of what beauty meant and what kind of work it does in popular culture.
So I'm curious what you thought about Lizzo's performance at the VMAs this year, which featured all kinds of bodies and shades and hair textures.
Yeah, so this is the thing that we don't like to wrestle with. It actually is different when Lizzo in her body does a performance as compared with Miley Cyrus doing the performance, which was actually just my larger point, that there is a perspective on Black beauty that Black women can still embody and perform with more latitude than white performers can do, because we cannot, however much we would like to do so, we can never change the history of what produced those two different performers. And so I liked Lizzo's performance. I like Lizzo. I mean, how do you not? Who doesn't like Lizzo right now? Lizzo is amazing. But I would still say that even Lizzo performing a certain kind of pride in her body is about exactly what I was trying to get at in that essay and what I expound upon in the sort of revised essay and the continuing argument I'm having with Black women in this essay, which is that we cannot control the terms of our beauty. Just like we can't control the terms of, policing or economics or residential segregation, we can't control it. We can control our response to it. But that feeling of powerlessness that comes from knowing that no matter what we do, we cannot control ultimately how Black beauty is defined in a majority culture and society, it does real damage to us, and not just our sense of self. This isn't just about self-care. Who is perceived as beautiful is attached to all kinds of other inequalities, economic inequalities and income inequalities, inequalities in criminal justice, and that those things should not be sacrificed. Thinking about those things shouldn't be sacrificed at the altar of self-care and beauty resistance, that even in resisting, we are acknowledging that something is being done to us.
Sometimes when I think about this issue, I think, oh, we should just, you know, just screw beauty standards altogether.
I know.
But here's the thing. Currently, beauty is currency for a lot of women.
That's correct.
So in some ways, when I think about it, like, well, I guess it does make sense to chase the beauty if it is currency. Mm-hmm. So I think we need to be asking the question, what needs to happen so that beauty isn't mm-hmm. the only currency for women?
Exactly. I argue in the text that beauty is the only legitimate currency allowed women writ large, by the way. It's one of the few currencies we are allowed to pursue, if not own, but to pursue without being sanctioned for doing so. And that is precisely why it's such important currency and why I think we invest in it so heavily. But my larger argument is that it is the system of pursuing it that makes it so valuable. And until we can talk about that, till we at least have a language to talk about, yes, I'm going to do my Instagram beauty videos, but when I do it, I am feeding into the system, even if it's the only one available to me. But listen, ultimately, I just want us to have the language to talk about why these things that can sometimes feel good are not always ultimately good for us.
You write about in the price of fabulousness, you mm-hmm. write about inequity. And what I took away from a lot of it was the idea of invisibility mm-hmm. of people and people who are poor. And you mm-hmm. write this line that says you have no idea what you would do if you were poor until you were poor. Why is there a lack of sympathy, empathy for people who find themselves being poor?
I think there is a deep cultural fear that is necessary for our ideas about meritocracy to exist. We are deeply afraid of becoming the people that capitalism spits out, even as we're being spit out by capitalism, by the way. But the idea that poor people are a visible sign, are visible evidence that we are not entirely in control of our destinies, creates in us a deep revulsion, I think, rooted in fear. When we see people who have done everything right and are still homeless, for example, still don't have the food or the healthcare that they need, it reminds us of how vulnerable we are to these social forces that can shape our lives against our individual will. Now, we wed that to all other kinds of identities that, oh, it's about women who have babies they don't need to have. Oh, it's about Black people, and it's about immigrants, and it's about people who talk funny or look funny, and if they would just follow the rules. Even when we know the rules don't work the way that they should, I really do think my most empathetic read of this is that we are afraid of figuring out that the rules on which we are relying for our own safety and security are so fragile and really can operate on a whim that is not our own to completely change our lives at any time. And so we culturally really have a deep derision for poverty and for poor people especially.
And you get into the idea of status symbols as gatekeepers, certain kind of handbags or
yes.
designer shoes.
Yeah.
How did you hope to make us think about what we judge people on and how we judge people?
Mm-hmm.
People's
you know,
worth.
There's, yeah, we have this narrative, and, you know, listen, we can pick any story. You know, there's one almost every other month about what is, you know, X poor person doing with X luxury good. Now, on any given day, that's what are they doing with the latest iPhone? What are they doing with a big screen television? But we really, really like the narrative about women and women of color, about them buying expensive luxury goods, a handbag, expensive shoes, expensive, you know, beauty aids, hair, makeup. I think we have a particular kind of derision for women because our culture doesn't value women. And then we have a particular kind of derision for Black women because, in addition to that, we don't value Black people. And what I wanted to show is that the luxury item that we think of as just an object, our ability to think of it as an object is a function of our own privilege. It is just an object to you when you can afford it. It is so much more than that when you cannot. And in fact, sometimes the social cost of having a purse or having some shoes or having the right hair or outfit can be the difference between you being able to access a job or housing or transportation and not. Right? The security that luxury goods provide for people exists for a reason. That's why the rest of us buy them. That we don't buy them just because they're beautiful or they make us look good. We buy them because they communicate something about us. That's what consumption is about. It's about way more than having a functional good. And sometimes the poorest among us need whatever small benefit that they can get from purchasing something that we think they don't deserve to have. So I hope, like almost everything I write, that it develops the capacity for empathy in people.
My guest is Professor Tressie McMillan Cottom. The name of her book is Thick and Other Essays. So you have an essay in your book titled Know Your Whites.
Yes.
What does that mean?
Well, it means we better know our whites. No, so I borrow this saying from some of my Black Southern kin who have this idea. What they're really capturing is this idea that it is paramount to your safety and your security and your well-being to know the racial order wherever you are. Now, when we talk about racism in our culture, we tend to talk about, you know, capital R, the big forms of racism. Or we talk about the really small racisms, which are, you know, those interpersonal slights between people. But the kind of racism that I'm trying to get at when I talk about racial order is that it can look different in one place. Racism can look different in California than it does in New York even. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't even account for different types of different regions across the country, much less how racism looks internationally or globally. But the big R racism exists everywhere. That's what colonialism and imperialism has done. It's imported a racial system, a racial caste system everywhere in the world. But the rules of it can be different depending on where you are. And to know your whites, that saying is about capturing what is fundamentally a political philosophy that comes from Black people's understanding of the world, which is to say, for your well-being, you need to know where you stand and what the rules of engagement are as they relate to race and racism. And generally, those rules stem from whatever a culture's value of whiteness is in that moment. And so to know your whites means that you need to know when you're driving through new and unfamiliar territory, how you speak to each other. Right. You need to know who is considered at the bottom of the social caste wherever you are so that you don't violate the norms and put yourself in danger. Knowing your whites is knowing that when you call the police on certain types of people, as we see today, that the police are going to respond in a way that can end in violence or that can end in a way that brings about peace. And that to know the difference means having to make different sets of decisions.
How do you see knowing your whites playing out in the presidential election thus far?
Oh, wow. Oh, that's a great question. I think that knowing your whites is about understanding why we arrived at this place, how we came about, how we elected Donald Trump. And I'm using we here, capital W, we, because black voters didn't elect Donald Trump. But that's precisely the point. To understand that our society always had the capacity for electing a Donald Trump and that we still have the capacity for legitimizing him as president. And then that in this election, we are voting as much on that, on what white voters are willing or not willing to accept in this election as we were 50 or 60 years ago, that the rules of the racial hierarchy sometimes change. But the fact that there are rules, that never changes, and that elections may not be enough to change them, but they are really good indicators of where we are in our conversation, of how willing we are to tackle the ideas of whiteness and racism, and how they still very much shape some people's lives as opposed to others.
The name of the book is Thick and Other Essays. My guest has been Tressie McMillan Cotton. Tressie, it was really nice to meet you and talk with you.
Same here, Allison. I loved being on. Thank you.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.